most criminal cases, of course, you're not going to have any license suspension collateral consequences. Probably the most significant aspect or criterion in Brown versus Multnomah County is the punitive significance. And my comment in my letter about public opinion polls is, perhaps I should elaborate on that. I think it is highly presumptuous of the judge, trial judge or appellate judge, to sit on his bench and say what public opinion is. My reference to public opinion polls was that the only way you can truly determine what the public thinks is a good quality, scientifically structured public opinion poll is to public attitude on it. And that's what Justice Lindy is indicating has the key significance here. I submit that sitting on the court and making that kind of an estimate is simply inadequate. The fifth criteria, as I think we discussed previously, when the cases start out as a criminal prosecution, the arrest and detention and pretrial screening and so forth is inevitable, and I don't think that's invalidated by a subsequent reduction of the offense to a violation, because that happens very frequently. I don't think anybody here is taking the position that somehow it's unconstitutional to take a case that starts as a misdemeanor and sometime later in the process reduce it to a violation. All this bill tries to do is say, let's make this decision early in the process. My best guess, and that's all I think anybody can do, my best guess is that this bill would survive the challenge under Brown and Stevenson versus Olson. Because clearly we're not talking about any incarceration whatsoever.
Question.
Just bring it.
Just now for, can you advise us to what, I think you made reference earlier that in Multnomah County, apparently this is now the practice on some occasions, that the district attorney at time of arraignment in misdemeanor cases is making a motion apparently to reduce, I can think of one case which I'm aware, a shoplifting was, a motion was made to reduce it to an attempt crim mischief 3,
right,
and in effect achieve the same result. Is that, do you know how prevalent that is? Is that a standing policy of the district attorney's office? I know it may be difficult for you to speak for them, or do you know if that's occurring in other counties as well?
They have been here in the past. It's indicated, I think, to the committee that that's what's going on. As far as other counties, I can't answer. I do know, for example, last Friday, I spent Friday morning upstairs in our criminal misdemeanor arraignment court, courtroom 734, and we had about 10 theft cases come through, and half of those were first offenses. The district attorney said, Your Honor, I move to reduce this to attempted criminal mischief. Degree, which is the lowest crime you can get, and then an attempt takes it out of the criminal statutes and puts it into a violation category. I reduced the charge, the person pled guilty, I imposed a small fine, and I went on the way. And this is for first offense. And that's generally the position of the district attorney. If it's a first offense, shoplift situation, and if the amount of the property that was taken is less than dollar figure, and I'm not sure right now what their dollar figure is, but it got the impression of somewhere in the vicinity of about $50 to $75, then the case is reduced to that violation situation. And it happens every day. And what I'm suggesting ought to be accomplished under this is that that person should not be treated as a violation called attempted criminal mischief in the third degree. That person ought to be, it ought to be clear that it is a shoplifting case that is treated in a non-criminal fashion, but still involves a theft offense. That, to me, adds a little more credibility to the whole system.
Thank you. Judge Hargrave?
I'd like to indicate, first of all, that I agree.
Judge, would you state your name?
I'm sorry, yes. I'm Jim Hargrave, Circuit Judge from Lane County. And I agree with Judge Snoffer that certainly what we're all doing here is trying to make a prediction about what's likely to happen somewhere down the line in terms of the Oregon Supreme Court, because I think it's absolutely clear from the various people that I see, not only here at the table, but talk to, that first opportunity this bill's going to go up on appeal, and we're all trying to figure out what the result of that may be. I guess the thing that I am most concerned about here and think that we ought to be focusing on is whether or not we are, in fact, if this legislation passes, whether or not you actually create violations or not. It seems to me that's the real key question here, and whether by taking this avenue of allowing the district attorney to reduce or change the nature of an offense to a violation by simply saying we don't want that person incarcerated, whether you have in fact reduced that and changed that to a violation, and whether that then allows the prosecution to go forward without an attorney, which is obviously the whole point of the bill. The concerns that I have, and why I believe that, one of the main reasons anyway that I believe that it won't be accomplished, is based also on the analysis that is done in Brown. And if you start with this in the same order that they started with in Brown, you look at the type of offense, and one of the things that they say in Brown is that under that criterion, the court indicated that the characteristics of the offense involved bears on whether downgrading marks a genuine change in the public assessment of the conduct or merely seeks procedural shortcuts. And I think that, at least to me, it's abundantly clear that when we say we're going to reduce the whole constellation of misdemeanor crimes to violations by the simple method of calling them something different because the DA says they don't want to put the person in jail, that it certainly calls into question very strongly whether what we're doing is looking at any genuine change in the public assessment of the offense, or are we doing really what the bill is intended to do, and that is saying how can we prosecute this person without a lawyer. And I think that that's a very significant part of that analysis, and I think there the court in Brown was dealing with simply one offense. Here we're dealing with the whole body of misdemeanor law, everything from sexual abuse in the third degree, I guess, which is a Class A misdemeanor, on down. And I guess I'm just be a little bit surprised if the court would say that this bill shows that the legislature changed its mind about the seriousness of these offenses, but what it really did was change its mind about how much it wanted to spend on indigent defense. I acknowledge that under the penalty area, $250, I don't think anyone can make any kind of an argument that you wouldn't be into a violation type of fine at that point. I don't think you can call it criminal based on that. Collateral consequences, as I also pointed out, I don't think are very significant. But I think the punitive significance is another one of the areas of the analysis that are extremely important. And it goes back to the stigma or the condemnation that accompanies a conviction. And to say that we're going to call it a violation and prosecute this person for, say, sexual abuse in the third degree, I again find it rather difficult to believe that the community would find much significance in the fact that the person had a conviction as a violation for sexual abuse in the third degree as opposed to a misdemeanor violation. And you can go through any number of statutes and use that same sort of thing and look at it and say, you know, what difference does it make? We've called it the same thing. It's got all the same elements in it. The only difference is the district attorney decided that they didn't want the person to go to jail, and that's the only difference between this person standing here and this person standing over here. They called it the same thing. It's got the same elements in it. The state had to prove the same thing. Only this person has a different title when he's all done. It's not criminal. He's some sort of a civil offender. And I think the punitive significance remains equal in the eyes of the public. I'd be just astonished if people thought any differently, and that apparently is one of the things that the justices thought was important. Again, you go down to arrest and detention. These people are not going to be coming to court unless they have been in some form detained, cited, arrested, go through depending on whether they're cited, but if they're arrested, certainly the arrest, the booking, the searching, the printing, all of those things that go along with a criminal prosecution, just the same as the person who's going to get treated as a criminal, the person who is going to get treated as a violator goes through all of the same things, and there's absolutely, again, no difference at all. One of the final things in regard to this is the question that's raised by Stevenson versus Holtzman, and as it applies in Brown versus Multnomah County. I read Stevenson versus Holtzman a little bit more broadly than Judge Snoffer does. I've quoted from that in my letter that I sent here, and have indicated that not only has the court said that if you're going to get incarcerated, that you're entitled to a lawyer, but when you go on to read what the court has to say in that regard, see if I can find that. It's on the last. No, here's what I'm looking for. If you, on page 2, citing Stevenson versus Holtzman, the court said, although we could rest our decision solely on the Constitution of the United States, we prefer to rely also on Article 1, Section 11 of our Constitution, which provides, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall have the right to be heard by himself and counsel. We think the foregoing provision, no less than the Sixth Amendment, mandates the appointment of counsel for all indigent defendants whose conviction may result in the loss of liberty. I think it's interesting to note that, of course, Brown doesn't deal directly with that, I grant you, and I just received today when we got here a memo from the Department of Justice that deals more thoroughly with that, but to the extent the argument is used that, well, we can now incarcerate petty offenders without lawyers under the U.S. Constitution, I'd submit to you that under Stevenson versus Holtzman that you can't do that, and you can't use that as a springboard in this case. But really, when it's all said and done, I go back and agree with Judge Snoffer that what we're really doing is trying to analyze this in terms of Brown, because Brown is the only tool that we have to analyze this, and I obviously analyze it quite differently. And I think that the legislature takes a substantial risk of what would be a major change and a major program going down the tube, because it can't pass constitutional muster. And I do have another thing I want to say, but I'll wait on that. I have another area I want to discuss on that. That's generally an outline of my feelings on the bill.
Thank you, Judge. Mr. Geary, we have received your letter. I wonder if you could summarize the department's analysis of this problem for us.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bill Geary, Solicitor General, appearing on behalf of the Department of Justice. Also appearing on behalf of the department is Jim Mountain, the Deputy Solicitor. First of all, I guess I'd like to apologize for submitting our brief on this matter on the same day as oral argument. That's not our normal practice. We see significant constitutional issues relating to 2371, as I think everyone at the table does, and I want to begin by prefacing my remarks by clarifying what I mean by significant constitutional issues, because if the legislature were to pass House Bill 2371, either myself or Jim Mountain or one of our staff is going to be standing in front of the Supreme Court, and I'm certain that my words here in the letter that we submitted are going to be parroted back to us by the defendant, who says, see, the department thinks the bill is unconstitutional. Obviously, there are two sides to the issue, and the presence of various people at this table, I think, indicates that there are strong arguments on both sides of the issue. What we hope to be able to do is to shed a little bit more light on the issue by focusing on an area that really wasn't addressed by any of the other people, which we think is the most significant of the constitutional issues that you have to grapple with. We draw a distinction in our letter between the right to counsel and the right to court-appointed counsel. House Bill 2371 is addressed to the latter right, the question of when a person is entitled to receive court-appointed counsel if he is indigent and unable to afford to retain counsel for himself. The law with respect to the right to court-appointed counsel is not always distinguished from the right to counsel, although there is language in recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions that suggests that the Sixth Amendment really was intended to do no more than to assure that a person could bring his own lawyer to court if he was charged with a crime. Brown versus Multnomah County doesn't address that issue, but it does distinguish between the issue of the right to court-appointed counsel and the right to when you have a right to an attorney. We think that the fairest reading of Brown, given the statutory scheme that we're working with, is that you don't get out from under the right to counsel that is provided by Article 1, Section 11, merely by relabeling the crime a violation. And the reason for that is because of a fairly complicated reading of the statutes, which draws us to the conclusion that even though it is a violation, and even though there is no criminal penalty in the sense of jail time that could be imposed as a penalty for the crime or the violation, it is still, within the meaning of the statutes, a criminal proceeding. And as such, it falls within the language of Article 1, Section 11 that says that a person has a right to an attorney in a criminal proceeding. Our conclusion is, our best guess is, that the court would hold that even though it is a violation, it is a criminal proceeding and a person has a right to counsel as opposed to the right to court-appointed counsel, even though he's being prosecuted for a violation. The problem then, as we see it, arises in the equal protection context and the Article 1, Section 20 context rather than in a due process right to counsel context. And we refer the committee to the case of Douglas versus California, which is a U.S. Supreme Court decision involving the right to court-appointed counsel on appeal. And the Supreme Court in that case analyzed the problem from an equal perspective. The court held that even though you may not be able to say that an appeal is a critical stage of the proceeding, inasmuch as there is no, or at least the Supreme Court has never held that there is a constitutional right to an appeal, where the state statutory scheme provides for an appeal as a matter of course, automatically, if the defendant deems to take it, from a direct criminal conviction, and a person with money is permitted to hire an attorney and go into court and present his views by that attorney on appeal, it violates equal protection to not provide an attorney to an indigent who wishes to take an appeal. And the analysis at this point becomes a little bit confusing because ordinarily, of course, wealth is not deemed a suspect classification, and the analysis, as I read it, of Douglas versus California isn't based on suspect classification. It is based on the assumption that you're dealing with a fundamental right. You're dealing with a criminal proceeding and therefore a fundamental interest of the defendant. And you can't deny assistance of counsel to an indigent merely because he can't afford to hire an attorney unless you have a compelling state interest. The cost involved in providing counsel to indigent defendants on appeal is not a compelling state interest. And so therefore, the court held that you have to provide court-appointed counsel on appeal. We think that the same kind of analysis would apply here, except that there are a couple different wrinkles that you have to look at. First of all, there is no equal protection clause in the Oregon Constitution, but there is the Equal Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 1, Section 20, which many lawyers mistake for an equal protection clause and which the court in recent years has carefully distinguished from equal protection. And one of the differences in analytically between equal privileges and immunity and equal protection is that the Oregon court, in applying the Oregon Constitution, has rejected the fundamental right suspect classification strict scrutiny standard that the federal Constitution has been held to mandate and accepted instead a balancing test for determining whether there is a violation of Article 1, Section 20 when there are separate classifications created. We believe that under Article 1, Section 20, what the court would do would be to balance the interests of the individual defendant in having court-appointed counsel against the obvious interests of the state in not providing that counsel where the stakes involved are as small as we're talking about in this context. I can't venture a guess as to how that balance would come out, but I think that's what the committee has to be focusing on, is trying to make that balance yourself in determining whether the statute is A, politically, as a matter of policy, desirable, and B, likely to survive constitutional scrutiny. One other problem that I will mention is that even though I don't think anyone would contend that there is a federal right to counsel involved where you're talking about a violation, ordinarily the federal cases construe it in terms of petty crimes and serious crimes, and we're clearly on the petty side, and so there would not be a right to counsel as a matter of federal constitutional law. It doesn't appear entirely clear to me that that negates the possibility that the court would say, nevertheless, as a matter of equal protection, there is a right to counsel, court-appointed counsel, in this context, because there is an interest involved, an interest which the state of Oregon deems to be an interest in a criminal proceeding. And it is possible that the court would conclude that the strict scrutiny test employed in Douglas versus California ought to be employed in this context as well in determining whether there is a violation of equal protection. We would argue to the contrary, that it is not a strict scrutiny test, and then under the federal constitution all you must show is a rational basis. And so our analysis leads us to conclude that Article 1, Section 20 is the greatest hurdle that we would have to get over in sustaining the constitutionality of this bill. We think that under Article 1, Section 20, there is a significant issue presented and one that we hope you will address. I think that summarizes it. I ask Jim if he has anything further to add.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jim Mountain, the Deputy Solicitor General. I see that the department has managed to pack this panel with two chances to speak, so I'll limit my remarks to just supplementing what Mr. Gary is saying in light of what Judge Snopper said. Judge Snopper referred you to the recent Court of Appeals case in the City of Portland versus Tuttle, where the Court of Appeals held that applying some of the Brown analysis, there was no right to a jury trial in an infraction prosecution. Well, that's fine because, for these purposes, because no defendant in an infraction prosecution gets a jury trial. The problem is, and what's different about the procedures that would occur under this bill, is that there will be people who will show up with retained counsel. There will be people who proceed through a violation prosecution with counsel, and there will be people that will now proceed without it. The distinction will be whether they have money or not. And that is why we focus this committee's attention on the fact that, as in this case, which is distinguished from the jury trial case, there is an equal protection problem lurking in this bill. And we also point out in the footnote that there's kind of a reverse discrimination involved in this bill. For instance, what happens when the attorney, when the defendant, misdemeanor defendant, shows up in court at arraignment with court-appointed counsel, with retained counsel, with his private attorney? Is he not going to get, the statute isn't clear that he's going to get this possibility of a reduction to an infraction, because this bill takes that procedure and puts it into the context of allowing the judge the power not to appoint counsel. So if the person who comes in with counsel, who's able to afford counsel, not going to be able to get the benefit of this possible reduction, if not, then you have a reverse discrimination.
That I would not think would be the thrust or effect of the bill, but I understand the issue.
I just pose that as an issue, as the mirror image of the other side of
right.
Equal protection.
Could I respond to that?
Yeah.
Just very briefly, I think the he's not had the benefit of our prior discussions, but I think the legislative history, if you will, of our discussions made very, very clear that that is not possible under the approach, although given the context in which the amendments fit in the standards, I can be concerned that we've discussed this at some length, and I think it's very clear that whether there's private counsel at the time of arraignment or not is irrelevant. It's a question of the district attorney having the right of reducing a violation and following this criteria.
Jerry Cooper, representing the Governor's Task Force on Drunk Driving, also former prosecutor. I have concerns about the bill, and I think the constitutional issues have been pretty much covered in quite a bit of detail. One experience that I had in Washington County was that during the time that Brown versus Multnomah County District Court was pending in the Supreme Court, or getting to that stage of proceeding, we continued to prosecute drunk driving cases as infractions. Everyone who came before a judge was told, you have no right to counsel, no right to a jury trial, no right to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And people were convicted over a 2.5 to 3 year period. Well, that came back to haunt us, because all of those convictions now are basically being set aside if the person is rearrested under the Grenvick post-conviction relief doctrine. And I know in Multnomah County they did not try the cases on the infraction basis when it was concerned as to its constitutionality. My concern as a former prosecutor would be, if you play Russian roulette as to how the Supreme Court's going to view this approach, if it is found to be unconstitutional, you're going to have in jeopardy many theft, assault, sexual abuse convictions, potentially in jeopardy. I would hope district attorneys would not allow this process to occur on assaultive behavior and crimes of violence or sexual offenses. But there's no telling how district attorneys are going to apply this particular statutory scheme. Something else that concerns me as on a general basis is police today make arrests on the basis that the district attorney is going to screen the case and determine whether the misdemeanor crime can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And if the police only have mere probable cause, their tendency is not to make the arrest because they're afraid the district attorney will not issue on the case and they're going to be kind of left out open to civil suit. Because by the district attorney not proceeding, that's some type of tacit admission, and the police are scared to death of that. And I think this type of approach that's being proposed in this bill would allow the police to make arrests on cases they wouldn't ordinarily make today for theft or assault or sexual abuse. When the district attorney reviews the case and he sees he cannot prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, or the likelihood is not very great, then it will be tried as a violation. And of course, the burden of proof is less and there's no jury involvement or right to counsel. What's going to happen is many people will be convicted and will get a theft or an assault or a sexual abuse on their record, violation or not. And it's my experience that that will be used against people if they're rearrested for release decision purposes. It could be, at least. If they're convicted of a new crime or offense, it is something that can be considered a time of sentencing. And I just, am concerned that the district attorney isn't necessarily going to be looking at whether he's interested in jail sentence or not. It's can he sustain a conviction? That's the first thing. You've got to get the conviction before you worry about what you're going to do with the people. And district attorneys do consider that first factor, I think, to the highest degree. As a member of the, or legal counsel, the Governor's Task Force on Drunk Driving, it is the task force position that this approach, if it's going to be adopted by the legislature, should never apply to major traffic offenses. And that would be the not only driving under the influence, but attempt to elude, reckless driving, hit and run, and driving while suspended. Right now, all of those offenses, if you're convicted, with the exception of driving while suspended, the conviction results in a mandatory suspension of your license. People don't go to jail for these traffic offenses, but the sanction of a suspension and also the requirement of proof of future responsibility through insurance companies is a deterrent And I believe that by going to an infraction status, I don't believe that mandatory suspension could result, and under the present law, there'd be no proof of future responsibility required. Also, if the person's convicted, no matter if it's an infraction or not, it would go on their driving record, and I'm sure insurance companies would pay attention to that fact. If there's a reckless driving on the record, someone quite possibly is going to have to pay a higher rate. There are risks in the eyes of the insurance industry. So again, I would recommend that if this subcommittee is going to refer this bill to the full committee, that at least major traffic offenses be exempted. I have prepared an amendment to Judge Snapper's amendment, which I believe would accomplish that, that approach.
Representative Springer?
Jerry, just a clarification on your earlier point about how this is going to affect the test or standard that the police apply when they make an arrest. First of all, do you think that means there are going to be more arrests? And secondly, let me ask one step up the ladder. Do not district attorneys also use, if you will, the jury trial, the beyond a reasonable doubt, to wash out cases that they feel uncomfortable about as well?
They do today, but I'm saying under this approach, they would not necessarily be able to say that to a police officer or